What's the percentage of information that you forget after the first 10 minutes?
55%.
50%. 50%. After you've heard what I've had to say for 10 minutes, you've already forgotten 50% of it afterward. And so for that reason, the new people and those who may have forgotten something, I'd like to go over just a little bit of the things we talked about yesterday in terms of love being a verb. And I think the important thing about that idea is that many of us think talk about love as if it were some sort of state that we are in. And the important thing is that it's an action word. And I shared with you yesterday that something that we all have that experience of feeling loved or unloved by somebody else. And in fact, many of us will go out searching for someone to love us. The second idea that we talked about, or another one, was that we may be feeling loving or unloving towards somebody else. And I know that there, when we felt loving towards somebody, we felt great. And otherwise, these may be our sins of omission or sins of commission. And then finally, we all have had the experience of feeling lovable or unlovable within ourselves, just as I am. And that's really our own sense of our own worth. I think probably one of the most important concepts, and we're really going to be developing on this one today, is that for most of us, or in fact for all of us, as we feel loved, that gives us that ability to feel lovable and feel good about ourselves. And it's like our little friend the bunny, who says, as he said yesterday, "You're no bunny till somebody loves you." Now, we can take these terms and put them into a sequence, and we have also the possibility that as I feel lovable, and not as I love myself as is popularly talked about, but as I feel lovable, that empowers me then to feel loving towards somebody else. And if that somebody else, other person has that same sequence, and we eventually wind up with a relationship that looks like that, a reciprocal model of relationship. So one of the things I wanted to clarify, I didn't talk about yesterday at all, that may be worth bringing up. How many of you are acquainted with the idea of quid pro quo? How many of you have heard about that, quid pro quo? Don, do you want to?
Oh, it's a this for that.
All right.
A give and get.
All right. Yeah, this is what we're talking about when we talk about mutual back scratching. You know, if you scratch my back, then I'll scratch yours. And that is a situation that we've got it going on right over here. You see. But anyway, I'll scratch your back, you know, if you will go ahead and scratch mine. So we're talking under those circumstances about conditional love. But I also shared with you yesterday a different thing, and that had to do with what Confucius talked about as being reciprocity. Do not treat others as you do not want to be treated, stated in the negative. And of course, we're all well acquainted with it in terms of Jesus' golden rule, do to others as you'd have them do to you. But I also made reference yesterday to Buddha. And I didn't have the book with me that my wife had. But I'd like to share this with you, because I think it really says much the same kind of thing. The book is The Way of Christianity, Search of Spiritual Growth. And here's a statement being made in there. This is the Buddha speaking. And he is saying, "Look how he abused me and beat me, how he threw me down and robbed me. Live with such thoughts, and you will live in hate. Look how he abused me and beat me, how he threw me down and robbed me. Abandon such thoughts and live in love. In this world, hate never yet dispelled hate. Only love dispels hate. This is the law, ancient and inexhaustible." Now the thing I want to bring to your attention here is that word that he uses, that this is the law, ancient, already in the time of the Buddha. So, with those things in mind, I'd like to stress for you that this idea of a reciprocal relationship isn't something that is just sort of a moral exhortation that we're supposed to be loving one another and all of that. It isn't a moral exhortation. What it is virtually a description of what does happen in relationships. And that's very different than, "This is the way I ought to do it." It's really saying, This is the way it does happen. Remember why I mentioned yesterday about the fact, you know, violence begets violence. But at the same time, love begets love. So, going on from there, I talked yesterday about a young lady and her dad and their relationship. And that was a relationship in which they had a very unloving relationship, where every time they met, if you'll recall, the outcome was a very unhappy, unpleasant time. And when Karen came to talk with me, if you'll recall, I suggested to her that she had the ability to choose her own response to what happened to her in her relationship with her dad. She couldn't choose the experiences that she was having with her dad. Those she could not choose. But she could choose the response, her attitude, and she could choose her behavior. And what I suggested, as you'll recall, was that she may be having unloved feelings, but she could have a loving attitude, loving behavior, and change that then to a positive kind of reciprocity. So, I have just about three or four more slides I'd like to share from yesterday that we have then between us the relationship. And I like to think of that relationship as being a human weeing. And where do we say that human weeing, that relationship, our spiritual child, where is its womb? Remember? Where is the womb of the spiritual child? Okay, it's in the cup. And that's where our spiritual child, my wife and mine, we have that cup and we have a spiritual child of our relationship there. And the way we relate to one another, we can be very unloving toward one another and unloving toward in our relationship, and we can raise there a very ugly and very unhealthy spiritual child. On the other hand, we can be loving toward one another and have a spiritual child in that cup of relationship that is healthy and beautiful. But the one thing, and the final point that I want to share from yesterday is that I can do nothing about what my wife puts into the cup. In my relationship with my son, I can do nothing about what he puts into the cup. The only thing I can do anything about and that I am totally responsible for is for what I put into that cup. I can make it unloving, or I can make it loving. So that's sort of a review of where we were yesterday. And as we get into things today, I need to distribute some paper here. And I'd like to have you, if you will, inform me. Just use the backs of these, please. I'm hoping we have enough. If not, maybe you can split a sheet and give it to somebody next to you. Well, that's a terrible thing to have said, isn't it? Oh, well. I do have some more paper here that maybe can be used. I just realized that. On that sheet, I would like to have you jot down five things that you appreciate, that you like about yourself. I'm going to give you 1 minute to do that.
Only five?
Jot down only five. Go ahead. Love it. Love it. Okay, now I'd like to have you jot down, you probably anticipated it, five things that you would like to see different about you. Five things that you wish were changed. Same period of time. A minute. Okay, I think that's been about the equivalent amount of time. Let me share with you first, I'm not going to have you share these with everybody in the group. That may make you feel better. One of the things I do want you to take note of is the length of the list that you have of things that you like about yourself. And secondly, how long did it take you to come up with that list? Then compare the length and compare that time to the period of time involved in jotting down the things that you wish were changed. Now, if you responded like many people do with this, you're sitting there saying, well, what do I like about myself? And maybe coming up with two or three, maybe four, maybe you can squeeze out that fifth one. But when the time comes up to jot down the things that we wish were different, we can go, chunk, 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 there they are, and we've got them right down there. And that, for me, is the emphasis that we place in terms of the negative things, the disabling things that other people have told us about us as we've compared ourselves with other people. And there have not been nearly so many enabling kinds of things. The things that make us feel good, make us feel like neat people and worthwhile people. Now, I want to share with you or remind you of something that we talked about yesterday. The program today, obviously, is becoming ABLE. And remember that word ABLE has as one of its primary meanings that of being worthy of. And so that's what I'm talking about here when I say becoming able. We're talking about, if you will, virtually becoming worthy. And so we have then that sequence of the experiences that give us either an able attitude or an unable attitude, and the experiences that then cause us to be enabling of other people. And one thing that we need to be aware of is, so much of the time, we are involved in unhealthy communication relationships where the whole thing is disabling. We feel disabled afterward, we feel unable, we feel ill-equipped, and then we become disabling of others on that reciprocal kind of thing. Now, this has been sort of the theoretical sketch of it. I'd like to share some experiences with you. For those of you who weren't here the very first day, I mentioned that I use a lot of personal examples because that's the way I understand communication and that's the way I understand relationships as I've experienced them. And I thought one of the neat things that happened last night was Ron Jacobson in the forum shared a story that I could so well relate to. And it was a story, I'm going to do it much more briefly, I'm just going to give you the highlights of the story. But it's a story of a little boy who was in a class where the teacher said he wanted a picture, she wanted everybody to draw a picture. And the little boy couldn't think of what to draw a picture on. He was kind of a shy kid, and he just couldn't think of what to do it on. And then he came up with that wonderful, wonderful idea that he was going to draw a picture of the sun. And so he got an orange crayon, and he colored all over the whole sheet of paper. And that was so neat. Very proud of it. So he takes the picture to Mom. She doesn't have time to hear him. He takes the picture then to the other children, shows it there. He's feeling proud of that creative idea of that whole sheet, just orange. That's the sun. And the other kids don't have time for him either. And he takes it to the teacher, and what does he discover there? It didn't follow the assignment. That wasn't the assignment. You were supposed to draw a picture, and you just sort of covered that whole thing. And now you have to do two pictures. As Ron was telling a story last night, that the end story of that story was that the little boy committed suicide. Now, I'm sure what that really amounted to was a sequence of disabling experiences for that little boy. It wouldn't be just the one that would drive him to suicide, but a whole lot of experiences like that. And I think you can relate to that because I want to ask you how many of you consider yourselves to be good artists? You didn't hear my question. How many? One. Only one? Now, yesterday I asked you to draw a picture of my dog, and if we were to show that picture around, How would you feel? But let's go back a few years. Now, I know you were a child, and I know how children are, and how many children don't draw pictures? Doesn't every child draw pictures? How many of you had a child that never drew a picture?
I was a child and never drew pictures.
Okay, that's what happens. You see, you know, the pictures get drawn and then it gets shown very proudly to an adult. And the adult says, "Who ever saw a green cow? Or why can't you stay in the lines?" And we have that disabling experience that we can't be an artist anymore. Even though for many of us it was a major part of our early childhood and our leisure time. Now, we've all, under those circumstances as artists, been disabled. I want to share some personal experiences, some out of our family. Some of you are getting very well acquainted with our family by now. For those of you who don't know of our family, let me share one more time that my wife and I married going on 13 years ago. And at the time we married, my wife had 5 children, and I became an instant father of quintuplets at that point. So anyway, that gives you enough of the background for me to go on from here, because right after the wedding, we moved to Salt Lake. And again, for those of you who weren't here, we had 3 teenage sons, 14, 15, and 16. And we moved up to Salt Lake, and I was on a sabbatical leave going to the university up there. And one of our sons got an idea, he shared with the other one, and they wanted to go back to Spokane for the summer. Or at least they wanted to go back to visit. And at the same time, they were asking for 10-speed bicycles. Now, I started putting things together, and I thought, there's no way that we can afford a trip to Spokane from Salt Lake for both those boys, and pay for the bicycles too. So I asked them, would they consider a proposal? And my proposal was, if they wanted, I would be willing to pay for the bicycles, and even go beyond that to getting some gear for them, and they could ride their bicycles the 700 miles up to Spokane, if they really wanted to do that. Now, we had a real interest in doing that, because can you imagine what it would be like for two young men to take part of their summer and ride 700 miles up to Spokane, Washington from Salt Lake City, over the mountains? You know, what a neat experience, and what would that do to their self-esteem? And that was the real investment that we were seeing in that. Well, the boys took us up on that. And we got their gear, got the bicycles, got the gear, and one morning they took off. That afternoon, we got a telephone call. They were out on the desert. They'd gone off on the wrong road, and they were headed to California instead. And they were really down. So we went out, we picked them up, we took them an equal amount of distance up on the road to Washington and let them take off again, and they did. And they were gone for, must have been about 6 or 7 days before we heard from them, but they made it. And as we checked with them later, they had only ridden their they'd ridden their bicycles all the way except for 20 miles over the top of a mountain. They didn't, you know, they put them in the back of a pickup. Now to me, that was neat. I found out probably about a year or two later, that after these guys got up there, number one son was riding with his dad in a new pickup, new to his dad. They were riding out in the countryside, and the dad said to number one son, "You know, Ron, you and I are like two peas in a pod. We're both losers." Now, think about the potential disabling impact of that kind of a statement. And can that ride to Spokane offset that kind of a disabling kind of a relationship? Can that do it? Now, the chips aren't all in yet. The votes aren't all cast. So we don't know at this point whether that was disabling or not. About a year later, we had a very neat event. We'd gotten back down to Phoenix after my sabbatical, and the neat event was that my wife had become pregnant, and that was very special. And we had one member of our family for whom it was especially special, and that was our little girl. She at that time in Phoenix was 7, but at age 5, when I had gone up to visit them, to visit Anne, I was over at the house one evening and I went in to say goodnight to the little gals, 5 and 7 at that time. And this little gal sort of looked up at me, and she had the most impish expression on her face. And she'd look over at her sister, she'd look up at me, she'd look at her sister again, and then she said, "Peggy and I have been talking." "And we want you to marry Mommy." "Because then we can have a baby." And she and her sister really wanted us to eventually have a baby. So here, several years later, or a couple years later, that was coming out to be a reality. And I couldn't understand it when that very much wanted baby was born. And this youngest daughter of ours was not excited at all. And I couldn't understand it why she didn't want to do things, you know, with this new baby, this new doll, this living doll that we had. And instead she was going to her room and she was writing stories about how much she, or that there was this little girl who had a daddy in a far off place who would really love her and care about her and all of that. And it wasn't until a couple years after that that I found out what had happened. That in the second grade, our daughter was called up to the teacher's desk, and the teacher said, "Lisa, I understand that you have a new baby in your home." And very proudly, apparently, she said yes. And the teacher wanted to be helpful and let her know that this new baby was her daddy's real baby and real child, and that he would not be able to love her as much as he would his real child. And she had to understand that, and the teacher wanted her to understand that. Now, for me, our relationship, my daughter's and mine, has at that point been disabled. And it is not overly that great right now. I don't know if that's what we have to overcome, but the reciprocity is still there, negative one. Now I want to give you one last example out of my own experience here. And that is that after we returned from Salt Lake, I was working in my office and I was working on a bibliography on the topic of hypnosis. And there was a lot of typing that had to be done and so forth. So in one of my classes, I picked out a young lady that I thought was probably the brightest young lady I had. I asked her if she'd like to be my secretary for a while, and she said yes. And so she came in and she was typing on this bibliography on hypnosis. And then we reached the end of the term, or probably a month away from the end of the term. And on one day, I said, "Well, Vic, I imagine you probably won't be coming in as frequently from now on." And she said, "Well, why not?" I said, "Well, because a final's coming up. And so, don't worry, I'll come in, I don't study anyway. I said, oh, really? What kind of grades do you get? Oh, mostly D's, C now and then. And well, you know, that really surprises me because, you know, you really seem very, very bright. I And Stono, my folks say if I'm going to make it, I'm going to have to make it on my looks and on my personality. And I said, well, that really surprises me. And so, as I thought about it, and I realized that she had expressed some interest in hypnosis as she was typing those things, the next day when she came in, I said, Vic, would you like to learn something about what you've been typing about? And she said, yeah. I said, all right, the best way to learn it is to experience it. So let's set the typewriter aside, and we'll just use our time today, and I'll teach you some things about hypnosis. And so I induced a trance, and a couple trances, and gave her some experiences there that were that demonstrated really that she was a very good hypnotic subject. And then I asked her if she would be willing to do something very special if I promised that she would know the total outcome of it afterward. And she said that she would. Now, this was in hypnosis. I said, all right, what I'd like you to do then, Vic, is I want you to have a post-hypnotic suggestion. Now, I don't know if you're all acquainted with that, but what that means is that during the time she was in the trance, I would give her a suggestion about what her behavior should be afterward. And I told her that she would not remember that I had given her the post-hypnotic suggestion until the day that she walked out, or the time that she walked out of her last final exam. As she walked out to the door, she would remember everything that had been suggested. And she agreed to that in hypnosis. And so I told her then that I wanted her, any time that she had time on her hands, that she would choose to pick up one of her books or her notes and study for her final exams. And if somebody wanted her to do something and it wasn't really that important to her, that she would usually choose in favor of what was really more important. And so as she came in over the next number of days, I'd say, Vic, what did you do last night? And she'd say, well, my brothers were watching TV, they were watching wrestling, and they wanted me to watch with them, and I've never really been very interested in wrestling, and I had some fashion merchandising that I had to study, and so I just went in my room and studied for a while. And then she, on another day, said, you know, my friend Tom called and wanted me to go to a movie. I said, well, what movie did you want to go to? And he said, I don't know, we'll find one. I figured if he didn't even know what movie to go to, you know, why go? And so she stayed home and studied. And that was just sort of a delight to me. Final exam week came, and I waited for her last final exam. And she came to my door right after that. The suggestion had worked. She remembered everything that had gone on. She came to my door. She stood in the doorway, and she said, you so-and-so. And what was really neat, I still get choked up sometimes when I talk about it, was that about 3 weeks later, she came to register for spring term. She came to my office. She had tears in her eyes, and she said, for the first time in my life, I've got a straight A average. Now, what I want to stress for you here is, notice the disabling comments that had been made that made her believe that she was virtually unable, and realize how she had lived down to those kinds of expectations. Now, we're talking here about becoming able, and really the way we become able has an awful lot to do with our attitude. It's that next area up from in that last slide. That's where it has to do. Because we can do nothing, nothing, nothing about many of the experiences that life gives us, can we? They happen. If you want to, you can say they were fated or whatever, but we had nothing to do with whether we had the experiences, but we can have something to do about the attitude that we have toward them. And I have two students out of my background I want to share very quickly. One was a young lady who, just as she was starting her freshman year, a very attractive young lady, she went to a swimming party, and she was running around the house with the other college-age kids, and somebody was chasing her, and she ran right straight through an Arcadia door. Beautiful girl, right through that door. She was so very fortunate, it did nothing to her face. But it virtually made mincemeat of her leg. And so, you know, all the surgeries, all the repairs, all that sort of thing. But then after that, there was no more swimming. There was no more tennis. There was no more sunbathing, because this gal could not, would not expose her leg. She was so ashamed of that aspect of her appearance. And so finally, she came out from my debate squad, and her mother shared this with me. And I had occasion to talk with her, and I said, "Carolyn, let me tell you about some of the other people on our squad, because I know you have scars all over your leg. But I want to tell you that Steve has spent 6 months in jail before he came here. I want you to know that Mary's dad died a year and a half ago, and she's hurting. And what I want you to know is the only difference between you and them is that your scars are visible and theirs are hurting and are there inside. But the neat thing about that is there's a card out, and I think this fits very well. Carolyn wound up taking the attitude that I may not be perfect, but some parts of me are very, very good. And that was a neat attitude. So I had, just 2 years ago, another young man come to my office, and he wanted to share the fact that he didn't know what to do because he wanted to date girls. But he was so afraid that if he dated girls, at some point he might cross his leg and his pant leg might go up. And if it went up, the girl would see how badly gnarled his leg was, because it had gone through a thresher and was just terribly, terribly gnarled. And I asked him, I said, "Mike, are you your leg?" And his response was, "Yes." And to my knowledge, to this day, he still identifies totally with his leg. It's all virtually in his attitude. Now, how do we become able? And what I'm really talking about here is being able to love. We do it in the same way that we've been disabled. We do it by our experiences with others. And I'm going to go on to another slide that you saw yesterday. We have the enabling relationship, but we also have that puppy that right now the statement is off the screen, but we are lovable, Lord, because you love us. I want to share this with you because it capsulizes everything for me. If you were to look in 1 John chapter 4, verses 10 and 11, you would see virtually the equivalent of that statement. Now, I told you yesterday that there was a statement in Paul, and I thought it was, but I found out today that it was in 1 John. And the statement is, this is love. Not that we love God, but that he loved us and sent his Son as an atoning sacrifice for our sins. In other words, God is the enabler that allows us to be lovable. And it goes on with, dear friends, since God so loved us, we also ought to love one another. Now, my wife has, do you not, some slips that I'm going to have her pass out while I'm making some comments. I don't want her to pass out. I want her to pass the slips out. Okay. In other words, what I'm saying here is that I look on God as the great enabler. And it is his love that makes us able, and it is his love that makes us worthy. And I'd like to have you take that sheet of paper, and I'd like to have you now answer two questions for me and for yourself. The first one is, where do you find God? We experience God. Where do you find God? Now, just as an aside here, I want to share with you where I find him. I find God in coincidences. I heard a definition, I love it, that a coincidence is a minor miracle in which God has chosen to remain anonymous. And I like that very much. And to let you know how much of a coincidence is involved here, I was sitting out under the trees. I knew I wanted to use the statement that I just did from Scripture. And Norm walked up to me, and I said, Norm, where in Paul's writings is that statement that we are able to love because God first loved us? And he then said, I don't think it's in Paul. And I glanced down at my Bible and where it had opened, and it had opened to 1 John chapter 4, verses 10 and 11. Now for me, that is a coincidence that is a minor miracle. And then Norm, in his comment, used the term coincidence. And the coincidence of that was that I had wanted to talk about coincidences and I'd forgotten about it. And it was a neat reminder. So on that sheet of paper, as I said, I'd like to have you then jot down where you find God. The second thing I'd like you to do is to jot just very briefly notes of what you would describe as one of your God stories. I have a friend who talks about God stories, times when God has been there. I don't know what your experience has been, but I have not experienced God every day. Now, I've been in a relationship, perhaps, but I can't say, hey, God was here then. Oh, I knew God was there then. That happens just once in a while, just enough to keep me going. And that's the way it works for me. And I went to a Lutheran men's retreat, and this is one of mine. And at that retreat, the retreat master stood up and said, in the opening meeting, one of us in this group is going to be giving a presentation on the Cogatus, which the retreat was called, this Sunday in church. And I got a flash, I don't know where from, it said, you are going to be that speaker. And I thought, oh no, I'm not. And I decided that the one thing I was going to do was make sure that I was not conspicuous enough to be picked to be that speaker. And so I sat at the very back of the room for the rest of the time. I didn't really volunteer anything. That was one thing I made sure of. I would not volunteer. Then I came up with the idea. that maybe one way not to be that speaker was to get somebody else to be the speaker. And so I went up to the retreat master the next morning about 10:30, and I said, I've noticed John Weed over there. I think he'd make an excellent speaker on Sunday. And the retreat master said, I think you're right. By the way, you've been nominated too. I said, oh. That night, four names were called to meet with the retreat master. John Weeds, two others, and myself. And I sat there in that chair saying, I'm going to fight it to the end. And the retreat master asked the question, how do we go about picking one of you? And I said, why don't we draw lots? Pretty nice, huh? So I was sitting at one end of the row, the four of us, and so they started at the other end. The first speakers, or the first gentleman sitting there said, well, it's not me. Second speaker said, or second person said, me either. Third speaker turned to me and said, it's you, John. And that for me was a God experience. Because I had really resisted as far as I could and still wound up being that speaker. But what made it a super God experience for me was that I, at that Cogitus, the first topic was one on listening. And in fact, the topic was listening is a ministry. And I had gone to that Cogitus with an idea of, hey, Lord, what is it that you want me to do from now on? And I'd been teaching listening skills for years. And it was sort of an affirmation that, hey, you've been doing a ministry all the way along. And so I decided in my presentation that Sunday that I would talk about that experience and I would talk about listening. And after the service was over, the retreat master, who was a member of that church, virtually worked his way through the crowd, almost running to the front of the church. And he said, John, I don't know where you got that topic, but that topic was the topic that this church had to hear. They've been rankling, they've been in dissension, they have not listened to one another, and that was the one topic that they had to hear. And that for me was one of my major God experiences or God stories. Now, I'd like you to think now, what is your God story?